Right, hi everybody. My name is Tom Percy. I'm from a creative agency in London called Flying Object. And I am here to tell you about a project we did with Tate last year called Tate Sensorium. A little thing about us, we are a very small creative production design studio. We do work in installations and exhibitions, in digital interactive, and also a lot of video production, most of which is for commercial clients. We work both in the cultural industries as well as in the commercial industries, and I think doing both allows us to have a good perspective which we can cross over from both sides. It's Tate Sensorium I want to talk about today. So if you're unfamiliar with it, Tate Sensorium was an exhibition, small exhibition at Tate Britain last year, in which people were asked to experience art with all their senses. Essentially, it composed of four rooms, each with a key painting from British art in the 20th century. Tate Britain is the sort of holder of British art for the UK. And in each of those rooms, we built multi-sensory environments. So in the first one, you had things you could smell and you could hear. The second one, things you could touch, as well as sound. There was sound and smell in the third one, and the last one, taste, smell, and sound all came together. The exhibition was also designed, as you can see, in quite an unusual way, which I'll get into a little bit later. And we also invited people to take part as an experiment. The whole premise of Tate Sensorium was really as an experiment, an attempt to understand more about what doing this means in a museum environment. But also people were invited to be part of that experiment, so we gave them biometric devices which measured their measure of sort of awareness as they went around the museum. And at the end, we printed off some data about this, handed it back to them, and showed them what their body was doing while they were walking around the space, and how to sort of compare the two together. And then we turned that data into a chart for the permanent collection at Tate Britain, so they could go around and find paintings which they might appeal to them based on their responses, things which might kind of bring sort of senses of smell or senses of touch, for example, to the fore. Just a sort of side note on this, people really liked those graphs, and one of the sort of major things we got on Twitter was people posting the pictures of the graph on Twitter. So why did we do this? It's a very kind of important question which a lot of people asked. There's been a lot of research in the last 10 to 15 years over the way that the brain brings together our different senses to form a perception of the outside world. We used to believe that when we saw something, that was dealt with by a part of the brain which is dedicated to the visuals, and that was separate from what we heard or what we smelled. It turns out that actually, the way that we hear, smell, see, touch, and taste things all mingles together in the brain and creates our sense of perception on the fly, depending on what's going on around you. This means that even if you're not deliberately trying to give people things to hear and touch, and, for example, you're still creating an impression in people's minds. So when you bring people into a big, sort of ornate, beautiful gallery with sort of echoey sound, sense of hushness, nothing to smell, nothing to touch, you're creating a sense around the artifact that it is very special, it's very rarefied. Not all paintings, not all things were created to be seen in this context. So we thought we'd like to challenge that and really kind of turn the idea of the museum upside down by making it dark, by making it smelly, by making it loud, and see what that did to the way that people reacted to the artworks. The other interesting thing about this is it's a kind of an interesting concept for people to deal with. So although it was only four paintings and a sort of short exhibition which was free and lasted for 20 minutes, we actually got global press coverage because of the idea of Tate working with this very new kind of science and the very new kinds of technology, which I'm going to talk about in a little while, really attracted the attention of, for example, The Guardian, Wired, Independent, Wall Street Journal, Le Monde, and so on. So I want to talk about three things today. How do we work with Tate and our own team? How do we work with the technology? And what do we learn? So working with Tate. So the IK Prize is the commission that gave birth to Tate Sensorium. The IK Prize is set up 3 years ago by Tate as a memoriam to someone called Irene Kreitman, who is a big donor to the gallery. And it really, its goal is to engage people from the creative and technology industries with museums to create these collaborations which allow us to see the British art collection in new ways. very first year this was demoed, you got a chance to remote control a robot around the gallery after dark and see through its eyes as it kind of ran around the gallery. The second year was us. The third year, which is this year, was sponsored by Microsoft, and it's all about artificial intelligence. So it's really interesting. It's quite a sizable grant, which allows teams like us, a very open brief, that was the brief, connect the world with art from the Tate Collection, to really come up with any ideas that we want. And all we had to do was write 100 words, send it in. We then got shortlisted, about 200 people entered, 5 got shortlisted, and then a panel of judges, including artists and curators, picked the winners. The way that we actually worked with Tate for this was sort of seems a little bit complicated. It actually comes down to a sort of very tight nexus. In the middle, we have a Tate contact with a producer called Tony, and then Flying Object, which is myself as a creative director, and my colleague Peter as the head of production. And we kind of organized everything. However, we were trying to build things to smell, hear, touch, taste, etc., and do a lot of science, and do a lot of software coding, and build an exhibition, and sort out all the lighting, and do the visitor installations and all the electric. So we obviously needed a much broader team. So we managed to kind of work up a structure which allowed each side to bring their own strengths. Tate managed all the marketing, the management of the artworks, curation, room build, electricians, AV, and so on. While we pulled together a multidisciplinary team of specialists to help us understand these different senses, whether that's a sound designer, fragrance specialist, a chocolatier who made the taste, a group of scientists who are really trying to understand what multisensory means in various different ways, and a specialist also in haptics, that's the science of touch. And we also want to design it in a very different way. So we designed the exhibition almost as a theatre show. So we worked with a theatre maker and lighting designer to help us really pull together the experience for the audience. With a lot of people around and a huge amount of things that we could potentially do, we realized early on we needed to have some firm design rules for what we were going to build. So we wrote these three rules, and every time we came up with an idea, we came back and checked them against these three rules. And they were, do the installations make sense to and impress visitors? You're standing in front of the painting, you're hearing these sounds, can you understand what they are? Is it baffling or is it fun? Is it making you think new things? Do they still allow people to react to and interpret the paintings themselves? What we're really keen to do is not shout down the paintings or cover them with anything. We use the lighting to focus your visual only on the paintings. There are almost no words printed on the walls at any point in time. So your visual focus is really on the painting 100% of the time. Alongside that, we were cueing these sounds or these smells, for example, to go off as you went along. But the whole point was trying to understand the painting itself and give yourself an opportunity to interpret that in a very personal way. And then three, are these things that we were creating defensible in the light of the artwork and the art history? So when I come to an example a little bit later, you'll see how we try to interpret the history of the painting and the context in which the painting was created into these other senses in order to give people a chance to be understanding that while looking at the painting, rather than having them look at a small card or at a booklet, for example. That said, we do realize that we were doing something that no one had really done before, and we'd never really done before, and Tate certainly hadn't done before. So we had to create a process for the team, this massive team, to work together, which allowed us to have some control over what was going to come out at the other end. So we started with sharing knowledge between us. We all walked around the gallery. We tried to understand how each of our specialists would think about these paintings. We tried to then take all of that information and tie the concept down to as small an idea as possible, come up with some initial ideas, test them, build those into small teams, test them again, make them better. We then did a whole full-scale dress rehearsal, and then we made them better again. So it's a constant process of prototyping, testing, which very much comes from a sort of technology startup world. And here's an example of one of our installations. So this is it's a painting by Francis Bacon. It's painted in 1945. Technically, it's a painting of his first art dealer, who then became his lover, sitting on a chair in Hyde Park in London. although at some point during the process he decided to overpaint the head with black over and over again. So it's a very dark painting. But unusually for a Francis Bacon painting, it's also got blue sky. It's got this kind of like ray of optimism. There's not a lot of optimism in Francis Bacon, if you guys are familiar with him. This is a very early painting. It's actually from 1945, so right at the end of the war. So what did we do? So for taste, this is where we made the chocolate. We created a small chocolate, which is kind of a chocolate shell, and filled in it was a sort of weird dust. And that dust was made out of charcoal, burnt orange, salt, and Lapsang Soochong, and that's smoked tea. So a lot of that was kind of riffing off what's in the painting. Charcoal obviously riffs off the black. The burnt orange kind of reflects the fact there are little flowers visible in the painting. The salt creates a sort of unpleasant taste, which seems to match what's going on, and also reflects off the amount of white that's in the painting. The Lapsang Soochong has kind of got a dual sort of idea in here. One is that it's about tea, and tea is a very kind of 1940s British thing to be thinking about, but it's also smoky. And they're kind of, we're kind of playing off the idea of the sort of smoke rising from the earth, this sort of sense of what London was like in 1945, of a kind of broken city which needs to be rebuilt. This chocolate was very unusual because it's very dusty. So that was almost a sort of haptic experience, a touch experience, but one perceived inside your mouth. And the reason for that is because during the process, Bacon picked up dust from his studio, threw it against the painting. We know that, you can still find it there. So it's very much a kind of sense of what his process was, being recreated in this very unusual way. For the sound, we went quite directly into sort of the context. So we recorded the sounds of Hyde Park today. He's wearing a woolen suit, so there's sounds of the wool, the iron chair that he's sitting on, but the chair also looks a bit like a machine, so we've got a kind of sense of machines kind of pumping back and forward. This is all mixed together by a great sound artist called Nick Ryan. He's actually a synesthesiac, so when he looks at paintings, he hears things. And he writes that down and then he builds up on the back of what automatically happens in his head. And then for the smell, it was quite faint in the background, was the smell of horses. And that's because in 1945 you would have had horses running around Hyde Park, not running around, being kind of led around Hyde Park. So how do we work with the technology? So there's lots of different bits of technology that we used in Tate Sensorium. One was the biometric wristband. This is a bit of a complicated and unusual piece of technology. It's essentially a small lie detector. If anyone is familiar with lie detectors, lie detectors use the central nervous system, which automatically responds to certain things which your brain is not in control of. It measures that kind of activity, which actually comes out as perspiration, as sweat. It's measuring arousal. So scientists use it to find out if people are scared or excited. It'll go up. It'll kind of trigger up if you laugh or if you cry, for example. It's quite blunt data, and to turn it into something we need to use a lot of maths, and also required a lot of work from the visitor assistants who all had to be trained on how this was going to work. It did, however, create these really interesting charts, and these charts were one of the most shared elements of the exhibition. So while I wouldn't all encourage you all to go out and sort of buy these quite expensive devices, which we were able to get for free because we asked, it is interesting to say to people that we're interested in how you feel about it and what your reactions were, and give them a way of expressing that visually, because people then own that, and then they own their own vision of the exhibition as a result. We also used a really prototypical piece of technology called ultra-haptics. This uses ultrasound to create a sense of touch on your hand, even though there's nothing actually there. So the device is here, your hand is here, and it creates impressions on your hand using ultrasound. It's quite weird. It comes out of Bristol University. It was a pre-production experimental device, and it's the first time they used it in a cultural space. This was a really interesting piece of collaboration, really, between Ultra Haptics and Tate, because Ultra Haptics have devised this thing, and they're not totally sure what it's going to be used for. They're currently thinking about cars. But here's an opportunity for them to test it in a whole new place. So they're able to lend us one of these for free and give us a lot of technical assistance to help set it up, so that they can understand what the premise was in the gallery. Meanwhile, it became a really key part of the offer to visitors, which is to try this piece of technology that no one has heard of before, and people really found that interesting and engaging. That said, we did have to design around it because it didn't quite work as well as we thought it would. So finally, what did we learn? So some of the things that worked I think that short brief that I referenced at the beginning to connect to the world with art from the Tate Collection, having a shorter brief does allow companies like us to have bigger ideas. It's obviously great to have sort of details and background and directions that you guys want to work on, but having a sort of short, concise goal is very important for a creative sort of agency to come back with ideas which are very expansive. We then wanted to make sure that we had belief in the creative process. So as I said, there was this kind of complicated process. It took about 6 months to design and develop everything. But everyone was really sort of bought into that, be them from the Tate side or from the creative side. And the product improved by having time to really work this through. About a month before we launched, we sort of rigged up this gallery using, you know, masking tape and sort of coat hangers and things like that. And we tried it out on about 100 friends. And we realized we learned a lot of things about that installation that just weren't going to work. People were confused, or they got lost, or things didn't work. We had a whole month then to sort of iterate and prototype and test again before we went live, and that's really important. Collaboration is obviously very much the theme of this morning. I think obviously our collaboration with our creative team was very important, but also having that kind of access to the client with Tate. So one of the important bits that we did early on is we went to Tate stores. All the paintings we used are not in the museum, they're in the stores in South London. And had a chance to really go and look at these things in real life and to really understand them and ask questions about them and spend time with them. So I think the more collaboration, the better. Generally, Tate were quite hands-off in terms of the creative input. They wanted us to have control. To be honest, I would actually like to spend a bit more time with their curatorial team to understand the paintings a little bit better. And I think your curators are sort of a wonderful source of knowledge within the creative industry. They are the archivists of creative work within the country. And to have access to those people is incredibly useful and incredibly inspiring for someone like myself. A key part of why it worked, I think, is also the idea. So this idea of experiencing art with all your senses, of multi-sensorial, an idea which is kind of beginning to become popular through restaurants, especially if you know Heston Blumenthal has a multi-sensory restaurant. That really communicated clearly to the public. And while we had a limited number of tickets and very little marketing, the public turned up in droves. And at one point we had, there was a queue of 3 hours for the, well, it was a queue of about 20 minutes for a ticket which is only going to be given out in 3 hours' time, because we limited the number of people who could go through the exhibition. And that was really interesting for us. They really got the idea, and the press really got the idea, and it really led people in. Another thing I should add on this, actually, is the people who came to the exhibition, we asked them at the end to give us an idea of their age and what they thought about it and whether they'd been to Tate before. And overall, they gave us 4.3 stars out of 5, which we were pretty pleased with. They were younger than the average Tate Britain demographic, which tends to be older, especially in context of other London museums. And a lot of them hadn't been to Tate Britain before. So we really were appealing to new audiences and to a younger audience, which is very important for Tate. Fifth, learning, so focusing on a story and on experience. What are people going to take away from this? When they leave the room, what are they going to remember? What are they going to tell their friends about? That story is what we wanted to make sure that we put together. The way it worked really was, the way we designed it, is that at the beginning you begin to learn about how your senses work. The very first painting we showed was a Richard Hamilton painting. Lots of different things being shown, collaged together and put together. And we played sounds which kind of riffed off all of these things. That was kind of the easy one, the starter one. By the end of it, you had the one that I showed earlier with the chocolate. That was probably the most complicated and difficult thing. You're sort of understanding your senses in the context of art at the same time. We also made sure that the paintings all sort of played off each other. They were all from a period of about 25 years of British painting, which is a sort of really transformational time in British painting, but they all kind of looked at different sort of schools, and they all joined together to make a kind of coherent view of what British painting was between 1945 and 1970. And then within that, we put the technology. We didn't let the technology drive what we were going to do. We didn't set out to use the crazy touch machine or to use the biometric devices. We really tried to focus on what that story was, what that experience is, and we put the technology into it to make it work. And then the last thing is to test everything. As I said before, test it as many times as you can. A few things that we do differently, I think if we did this again, we give ourselves some more time to install the project. We literally finished it the minute before the press walked in. We were still screwing something down when the first journalist was walking into the room. That was terrifying. If you put in a lot of experimental technology into a museum, it will definitely break. You don't know when it's going to break, but it's definitely going to break. So you need to be aware of that, and again, test everything and make sure you understand what you do when it does break. We kind of messed up the visitor flow a little bit. As you can see, this is day two. It got into the press, so there's lots of stories. It's Saturday morning, and it's a bank holiday as well, so everyone was sort of around and London was populated. And we had this queue of 200 people outside the museum before it opened, and that was an error. We shouldn't really have that. We should have dealt with this a lot better, but I think Tate didn't really understand how popular it was going to be. We didn't understand what the press reception was going to be. And then we didn't really have a solution when we had lots of people standing outside in the rain. And then the final thing is, we want to take this and make it more plug and play. What I mean by that is, how do we create sort of smaller bits of this which can be deployed much more easily? This is a very complicated and sort of quite fragile experience. Essentially, as I said, things broke and then we needed to rush in and fix it. What I'd like to do going forward is better understand the individual components of what we did, take them apart, and create things that you can put into a museum, not for 6 weeks, which is how long Tate's Sensorium ran for, but for 6 years. And I think that's what I would challenge you guys to think about when you're kind of beginning to think about museum exhibition design, is how can we use sound in a way to trigger people to think about things or to connect things in new ways? Sound doesn't just need to be someone talking in your ear about when the painting was made. It could be an effect. It could be a sense of something happening at the time. It could be something quite unrelated, but which connects you to a thought in your mind, which then triggers a sort of thought about the painting. Smell, in particular, is really related very closely to the way we think about memories. When we smell things, the way the smells are stored in your brain is very close to where they're stored and to where memories are stored. This means that smells can really bring you back to places or can trigger responses that you didn't really imagine. So in one example, we had a smell of wood, wax, a thing called pledge. And pledge didn't change its smell for 50 years during the 20th century. It's a honey and beeswax smell. And when we gave people that scent, which is playing off some parquet flooring in one of the paintings, people really had a sudden kind of memory, but something they couldn't really put down. It brought them back to the childhood one way or another. And that's a really interesting sort of frame of mind to put people in while they're looking at this artwork from the 1960s. Suddenly you're thinking about your school, or you're thinking about being at your grandmother's house, but you're looking at this painting. That gave people a much more sort of direct and kind of personal connection to the artwork, rather than thinking about it only academically. Taste is obviously quite a tricky one to think about in museums, but it is an interesting way to think about the other way around. How can we take the exhibition and turn it into a menu, for example, which could then kind of play off into the cafe or into the restaurant? If you know anything about Turner, he painted very violently. He kind of really kind of smudged it against the wall. And giving people that sense of how something was created through the way that he created, through the connection of his hands against the canvas, is a whole new way of thinking about something which, again, we normally think about behind a piece of glass, stood 10 feet away with a little piece of writing on the side. It just gives you another way into accessing that painting. So yeah, so that's, bang on time. That's me. I'll take any questions a little bit later. Thank you.